Audio clips from book, Looking for Orphan. The story of George Adamski. The first flying saucer contactee and how he changed the world. Of Colin Bennett. Foreword by John Mitchell. In a thousand years' time, if there are still people studying history, someone is sure to ask, what is the most important thing that happened in the 20th century? What will be the answer to that, I wonder? Almost certainly it will be quite different from anything we would think of today. In that case, an unlikely guess is more likely to come true than a likely one. So Colin Bennett is on the right track in suggesting something that few would suggest, that the defining moment of the 20th century will prove to be 12:30 p.m. on Thursday, November 20, 1952, when George Adamski met Orthon, a long-haired youth from Venus. It happened in the Californian desert in the presence of witnesses. From that moment, the cat was out of the bag, the space people were among us, and nothing has ever been the same since. That is a provocative thesis. But evidence has been building up over the near 50 years, from 1953 and the publication of Adamski's worldwide bestseller, Flying Saucers Have Landed, which he co-wrote with Desmond Leslie. Since then, images of the UFO and the space alien have continued to haunt us. The effects of this on popular culture are to be seen everywhere and, as Bennett points out, UFOs and space imagery has long outlasted the various fads and fashions that have since risen. In the modern imagination, the UFO is a constant, not just a spacecraft but a reminder that the world is not as rational as our educators pretend. The prophetic Carl Jung was quick to see what was happening. In 1959 he published a startling book on flying saucers, accepting their reality and interpreting them as signs and portents of the ancient gods, duly returning to change our way of thinking and initiate a new age. It was Jung's perspicacity, among other things, that led me in 1967 to write the Flying Saucer Vision. I just could not resist drawing attention to a phenomenon which, even though it was changing people's minds and lives, introducing new interests and perspectives, was scornfully ignored by the authorities. It was not just state officials who hated and mocked at any mention of UFOs. Colin Bennett is quite right in what he says here, that in the world of art and literature, during and after Adamski's time, talk of UFOs and related subjects was in no way cool, hip, PC or the proper thing. Right-wing types disliked it for upsetting established patterns of thought, while the intellectuals saw it as a plot to divert attention from their evolution. This has always been considered a radical subject, and for good reason, and that is why writers of Colin Bennett's quality are attracted to it. I really enjoyed this book, the author's wit and wisdom and the spirit in which he deals with the great events of our time. His story is about the current revolution in cosmology, the way we understand the world, and the switch from the old categorical judgmental approach to a more accepting and inclusive view of reality. He begins with George Adamski, and why not? He was an impressive old rogue, like Madame Blavatsky, and in the same tradition. Such people, according to Plato, are the kind whom the gods choose to enlighten us. I am sure that is right, and that changes in our minds are brought about by the gods, in their due seasons and often through highly dubious characters. John Mitchell. Introduction. In 1952, a Polish immigrant who worked in a restaurant on Mount Palomar, California, claimed that he had made contact with an extraterrestrial being in the Nevada desert. It wasn't the first time in history that a human being had made such a claim, nor would it be the last. But this particular meeting has reverberated to this day, influencing the very core of our contemporary culture. The immigrant's name was George Adamski. Over the years that followed, he would document his claim with photographs of flying saucers, dozen and dozen of photographs, in fact, and three books on his quite fantastic adventures. The first of these, Flying Saucers Have Landed, published in September 1953 in conjunction with the British writer Desmond Leslie, quickly became a bestseller and brought Adamski worldwide fame. Flying Saucers Have Landed is a masterpiece. It is a story of about our perception of history, the nature of technological power, and just who or what exactly governs the forces of modern belief. Its textual planes are like the distortions of a medieval map. Just one of its achievements is that it makes the ordered Cartesian perspectives of conventional literature look as if they have a similar distortion. In doing so, it suggests that perhaps the UFO itself lives between the folds of such cultural warps as did the sea serpents of old maps, appearing on most unsuitable and inconvenient occasions to baffle, hypnotize, and infuriate. To understand the Adamski phenomenon, we must ask whether a text is a mere something enclosed between pages, written by clever people with refined skills, or whether it should be considered as a life form in itself. One thing is certain, if we ever lose such bad and mad books as those of George Adamski, we will lose a delicately balanced psychic bond life as holy and valuable to us as the rainforest or the midwife toad. Many people who met George Adamski commented on his considerable charm and his good appearance and address. These things certainly helped him on his world tour of 1959, during which he met royalty and leading figures in military and intelligence, and acquired a mass of followers in many countries. He managed to enter power structures with ease, just as did the traveling astrologers and alchemists of old. The occultists Paracelsus, Agrippa, and Albertus Magnus all tell that when one world enters another and goes out again, after an years, no matter how brief a stay, it is never possible to get the furniture back in place. That is because thinking never really ceases to be a form of dreaming. For good or ill, when we imagine, we create a form of life, that is, a seeding of pictures and possibilities, a watering of secret hopes, private fears, and hidden ambitions. Despite his often comically hypocritical denials, Adamski was a classic magus. In this, he was right in the center of a war not of Desmond Leslie and facts versus fiction, but of posse facts versus abilities and allowances. In The Mill Lion Acres of Nonsense published Jacket of Hook published in 1953, about occultism, few realize that nothing is created by the sorcerer so much as allowed. It is a dim soul indeed who does not want to see the world turned upside down. There can be such a hidden subversive pressure built up in psychic realms that there is seepage of part worlds through a membrane into a social realization. Using these ideo-associative forces, an almost penniless Adamski pulled together high-level folk in a manner almost impossible to achieve by any other means. The occultist, like the pornographer, merely sets fire to imaginations. He knows what people really want. In this, the occultist is a ruthless salesman. Adamski's experience was the first modern powerful suggestion, with early technological trimmings, of a prototype pan-dimensional reality, and we had better get used to that situation, because a hybrid state of affairs is the microcosm of our entertainment state. To the thousand-channel consumer society hardly deals with the mechanical objective realities of the previous hardwired society. The death of a soap character is just as important a causation as economic need or social stress. In this intermediate state live aliens, the prototypes of which are the space brothers whom Adamski met in the Nevada desert. It should come as no surprise that he angered the scientific establishment of his time. He was accused of being a complete imposter, yet time and again that cap would not stay on his head, being always thrown off by some impossibly bizarre sighting, curious incident, or magnificent coincidence that would somehow, inexplicably, give his extraordinary theories and claims some shred of credence. Yet, despite the success of his books and his rise to fame, by the early 1960s Adamski had become a deeply disappointed man. Through scandals and accusations of every kidney, his worldwide support had dwindled, and many of his closest friends had deserted him. He died aged 74 on April 23, 1965. Did Adamski really encounter an extraterrestrial? Or were his first and his subsequent contacts and his many films and photographs all hoaxes? Was Adamski an imposter, or indeed a madman, who was out to fool the world? Or did he trip into some parallel reality that we are only dimly aware of? This book contends that whatever the truth of the matter, and the truth is not as easy to untangle as the skeptics would like, the influence of George Adamski's claim was enormous, and the term flying saucer will be forever associated with his name. Just one of the strange things about these strange aerial forms is that a half century after his death, they are still with us in the form of the UFO, or unidentified flying object. The crescent-shaped discs that American pilot Kenneth Arnold first saw flying by Mount Rainier in 1947 make flying saucers older even than rock and roll. Strangely, the flying saucer has not aged with this world. Though Adamski received ridicule in plenty for claiming to have contacted beings from other worlds, nevertheless, his dome-shaped flying saucers, along with the bikini bathing suit, remain with us from the time of the Truman Doctrine, the Marshall Plan, and the Korean War. 12. It could be said that Shakespeare didn't do too badly considering he could not write about politics, sex, or religion. The UFO does very well, therefore, considering it has nothing to do with race and class, drugs, economics, war, or terrorism. It has, of course, always been strong on entertainment value, stronger even than science, and far less destructive. In the time since the birth of the UFO, everything has changed, from jokes to the color of socks, but not the battle royal between believers in UFOs and scientists and skeptics. This battle appears at times to be a fight between different sets of wallpapering circus clowns, and 50 years later this rather simple extended joke does not show any sign at all of running out of steam. Few jokes last that long, and thus both saucers and bikini both are magically suggestive icons, pure unadulterated image stuff which has triumphed in time. Both are beyond all sense, fact, and rationale, those tyrannical elements of an old and fading industrial time. The facts of the late 1940s and early 1950s are gone, the scientific theories have been largely superseded, the clothes, conversations and cars of over 50 years ago have vanished, but the flying saucer and the swimsuit shaped like a Pacific nuclear practice range is still very much with us. Perhaps both the bikini and that which we now call the UFO stayed with us because we like reminding ourselves that the world is never quite completely real. Too many who feel that they live under the claustrophobic oppression of a factual culture that is practically destroying all land, sea, and air, that is a comforting thought. We bind such things to our hearts like pressed leaves whose personal code tells us that both matter and experience are conspiracies. As such, their plots can be subverted, and the good news is that there are rumors of gorillas in the hills, tales of lights in the forest at midnight, and, if we believe George Adamski for even a second, we may even see a white rabbit or two if we keep our eyes open. Though Adamski has become a much derided figure since his death, perhaps he will have the last laugh, if only because his donut and hamburger shapes are still up there on 1001 Nights of the World. It is as if the Mount Palomar restaurant of his lifelong friend Alice K. Wells had exploded into the air and was still coming down, with countless scores of the hot plate favorites Adamski himself must have sold to many ankle-socked and short-panted school parties from all over America. Some of these young visitors might now struggle to recall the face of the man whose dome-shaped flying saucers are like a rain of frogs. They still have housewives running into police stations, truck drivers consulting psychiatrists, they still produce anger from scientists, denials from governments, and very strange behavior from the intelligence services and the disinterested armed forces of the major nations. On occasion, even, a blonde male sylph of the kind to which Adamski appears to have been partial, still steps out of a landed UFO that has been detected by radar, leaves ground impressions, and has been seen by multiple witnesses. Adamski is therefore a battlement ghost from the immediate post-war world, appearing at the stroke of midnight to remind us of the disturbing yet exciting possibility that what we call reality may be far more scandalous an affair than previously thought. This is both the awe and fear at the heart of the UFO experience. Frequently baffled and even insulted is that very intellect which gropes for its fundamental nature. As with the Oswald syndrome, The UFO reveals events and implicit connections, movements of people, materials, and ideas, which hint at a world order so outrageous it is almost beyond all belief. The UFO culture that thrived after Adamski still reminds us of the night side of both man and nature. We experience a phenomenon that is infuriating, subversive, and quite impossible in its behavior. But ultimately, what is most important about George Adamski is that he structured one of the most blatant acts of visionary cheek of the 20th century. Far cleverer men have done far less. Though toward the end of his life he became a confused man, and was driven to making up lots of stories, he sounded many alarm bells within deep cultural bedrock. In telling such tales, like many world shakers, Adamski broke all the rules, and the world couldn't quite get all the pieces back again. In this sense, history has extreme difficulty in getting rid of Adamski and his deliciously silly stories. We haven't done with him yet. We need him if only because his views are quite wonderfully absurd. He is therefore nearer the truth of Salvador Dali, André Breton, and Alfred Jarry than the truth of the strange form of theosophical Christianity that he followed. While the UFO is with us, we are stuck with him as one of the founding fathers of ufology. Like the proverbial tin can tied to a cat's tail, he rattles through our dreams, shaming, embarrassing yet thrilling us still with a perverse intellectual eroticism which is absolutely irresistible. Such folk as he are healthy reminders that the truth may not be nearly as sober as we would like it to be. He suggests to us also that the old box of tricks we call reality now prove finally to be that fraudulent old rascal we always secretly knew it was. The question might well be asked as to why, in an age dominated by democracy and scientific rationalism, hasn't all this nonsense about flying saucers been put into the museum, along with the left, the twist, the class war, the revolution, punk, and flower power? From one point at least, its attraction holds no secret. Most of us love to see authority baffled, chasing its tail, its tools of control and oppression no longer of any use. The flying saucer, like the modern UFO, never held persons or placas in great respect, appearing to a group of starving peasants in Mexico just as readily as to an airline pilot over the Atlantic. It is also still capable of generating new interest sectors, new shapes, and new roles of its developing self, such as different kinds of abduction scenarios. As soon as media or the various military or technological establishments either ignore it, or put it down, it streaks across the sky, frightening motorists and cows in fields. It appears on radar, leaves ground traces, and as soon as comes the scientific denial, it is seen by policemen on bicycles, pilots in the Gulf, and housewives pegging clothes on a line. One thing is sure, the UFO greedily dines off all explanations, weathercath lights, searchlights, little green men, creatures from other dimensions, super bees, or intelligent cabbages. When we view the shattered life that Adamski weaves between his books, we glimpse multiple dimensions of establishment and military intrigue, and intelligence allied with conspiracy. Like many visionaries, his life was finally a broken affair, fragmentary and incomplete, and almost as unbelievable as a Cottingley fairy photograph. But if humanity ever loses such heroism born of Adamski's deep refusal to believe in the world as received, it will be lost forever. If he had ever looked down from his tightrope, he would certainly have fallen, another victim of the breathless cheek of the sheer intellectual eroticism of all prophecy and vision. 15 If most people are terrified by the unusual, those whose lives are committed to thought, as Adamski's life certainly was, are equally disturbed by the everyday mundane scale of affairs. They see any social conformity as a vast imposture, just as evil as the more obvious moral demons. Adamski had something in him of the dark genius of the covered wagon and riverboat rascals of Mark Twain and Herman Melville. Like Howard Hughes and Del. Ron Hubbard, he brought down fire, if not from heaven, then certainly from an elemental somewhere. But unlike Hughes and Hubbard, he didn't make any money, and so America ignored him. But America will have to face Adamski sooner or later, and bring him, if reluctantly, into the pantheon of scarred American heroes. Like many with a streak of genius, he didn't really know the difference between work and play, dream and religious impulse, inspiration and rational thought. But his faulty intellectual grasp saved him. It allowed him to play with all these things, and in playing he chanced upon something that talked to him. But like François Sorel in Alain Fournier's novel Le Grand Monde, Adamski was to lose the enchanted house in the forest that once he saw. Like Ahab, the quest finally consumed him, and like Hemingway's Old Man, he was left with only fragments of wonder as a magical defiance of time and decay. When we say that what Adamski saw was created by his imagination, we show how far our world has fallen, not progressed. We seem to have forgotten that there is nothing at all which is not conceived by the imagination, and that includes fact in itself. In forgetting this, we have lost the long trail between the ravings of visionaries in back rooms, the launch of a space station, and the death of a president. If Adamski's life can do anything at all, it can teach us how to rediscover that trail. Chapter 1. When we imagine, we create a form of life. George Adamski was born in Poland on April 17, 1891, of parents Joseph and Francis Adamski. When he was 2 years old, his family immigrated to Dunkirk, New York, where he grew up in poor circumstances. An FBI memorandum to J. Edgar Hoover on January 28, 1953, mentions three sisters, but no brother. Three. This is odd because on occasion Adamski talked of a younger brother who he said was a priest, and who came to Pelham Gardens to see him occasionally. Adamski had little education, and he took what was one of the few options open to him and joined the army. Most sources mention that from 1913 to 1916 he served with K Troop of the 13th U.S. Cavalry in the Mexican War. This was probably the last war in which romance and heroism played against a landscape and climate full of the excitements of revolution and high adventure. His early youth was charged therefore with overwhelming excitements, and they may have permanently supercharged his later life and created a need to relive some of its vital inspirations. He was certainly blooded by a fantasia of historic names. He pursued Zapata and Pancho Villa no less, UFO Kintakali George Adamski, serving under General Pershing, whose aide-de-camp was a young seconds and lieutenant by the name of George Patton. His Arlington gravestone mentions his National Guard unit, the 23rd U.S. Guards, and his active service status is confirmed by the mention of World War I. Although he did not serve in Europe. As Hemingway might have said, a man who fired the old Springfield rifle at the dusty hordes of Villa and Zapata is a man to have a drink with. Certainly, as one of the last horse soldiers of America, Adamski would have looked good and menacing on a cavalry steed patrolling the Mexican border in the years just before the Great War. His features, staring out from black and white photographs of the era, are more Greco-Florentine than Polish, and in a good light, he could be Tommy Lee Jones doing Aristotle Onassis in a new episode of The Godfather. Adamski's face is a piece of interesting simulation in itself. He looks like a desert man. His sinewy leonine body and his Indian chief's features match the desert rock and scrub in which he would make his first contact with a spaceman. In grainy photographs, he looks risen from the desert itself. As a young man, in the many Italian restaurants of the young Al Capone's bootlegging America, George Adamski might well have been quickly and quietly ushered to the best table, given no bill, and asked no questions. On Christmas Day 1917 Adamski married Mary Szymborski, a devout Catholic. After his marriage, in that same year he was honorably discharged from the army. In 1918 he worked as a government-employed painter and decorator in Yellowstone National Park, and also in a flour mill and in the cement business. Part-time, he served also with the National Guard until 1919. During the time of the Prohibition, 1920-1933, Adamski claimed that he bootlegged alcohol, which if true is a claim that puts him in some very good company indeed. During the Prohibition I had there, Royal, Order of Tibet, he would tell contactee Ray Stanford a quarter of a century later. It was a front. Listen, I was able to make wine. You know, we're supposed to have the religious ceremonies, we make the wine for them, and the authorities can't interfere with our religion. Hell, I made enough wine for half of Southern California. In fact, boys, I was the biggest bootlegger around. If it hadn't been for that man Roosevelt, I wouldn't have had to get into all this saucer crap. This was almost certainly an example of Adamski's rough humor, which according to Lou Zinzag, the co-author with Timothy Good of George Adamski, The Untold Story ; 5, he had in plenty. There are dangers in being too puritanical about human beings. A priest in a private and relaxed moment is surely free to say that he could have made a lot more money if he had put some of his congregation on the streets instead of in the pews. When asked about his profession or means of livelihood, wrote Zinzag of Adamski, he replied that for some years before he settled in Mount Pelham he gave popular lectures on astronomy and philosophy, in New Mexico, Arizona and California. He called himself a kind of wandering teacher, visiting settlements during the winter months, when farmers had little to do and were pleased to see him. There was no TV then, he said, and people were grateful for lectures or entertainment of any kind. In the late 1920s Adamski settled at Laguna Beach, California. Here he taught a form of Oriental mystical philosophy combined with very strong Christian fundamentalist overtones. This view was based partly on the theosophical teachings of both Madame Blavatsky and Annie Besant, who was president of the Theosophical Society from 1907. This view was influenced also by Rudolf Steiner, who taught a Christianized view of theosophy. Adamski called his particular version of his kind of belief universal law. The spaceship chief he would meet during one of his trips into space claimed to have been carefully watching him during his formative years, and was therefore fully aware of the kind of spiritual teaching he developed during the interwar period. The chief addressed him as a prodigal son, referring to what Adamski himself called universal law, this being a kind of cosmic moral paradigm which binds together the entire animal, mineral, and vegetable universe. As Earthmen consider this law, they will see and understand how all is working from the low to the high, which is the universal purpose, and not from the high to the low. Yet the power expresses from the high even unto the low that the low may have the strength to rise unto the high. There is eternal blending, but never division. 6. A further example of the Sunday school content of these lectures illustrates what Adamski thought was a scientific approach to philosophy. The Big Chief speaks, in the full conception, all manifestations of all forms are like beautiful flowers in a vast garden where many colors and many kinds bloom harmoniously together. Each blossom feels itself through the manifestation of another. The low looks up to the tall. The tall looks down to the low. The various colors are a delight to all. The manner of growth fills their interest and intensifies a desire for fulfillment. If we feel comfortably superior to this kind of simple-minded philosophizing, it must be borne in mind that there is considerable evidence that Adamski practiced successfully as a healer. There are 3 examples of this given in Gray Barker's book of Adamski, showing that he certainly gave great comfort and spiritual uplift to many stricken with often fatal illnesses. Lou Zinzag also gives an example of Adamski correctly analyzing a young boy's eye defect in the presence of a doctor, who was impressed. In Adamski's own words, his life was dedicated almost entirely to metaphysics, psychism, and religion. In this he was certainly a prototype of many hippie-style teachers who were to come after him in the 1960s. The natural law principles that he formulated were rather like our own New Age conceptions, though mawkishly expressed, more often than not. At worst, Adamski was a time waster, at best, he showed good environmental sense, reflecting the views of Rachel Carson's Silent Spring. He mirrors also the early green view of such writers as Jack Kerouac, the American novelist, and the occultist and chemist Jack Parsons. One the founding fathers of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory who wrote Freedom is a Two-Edged Sword. 8. Though he was not a particularly clever or well-educated man, Adamski blended a strong intuition with limitless enthusiasm and a powerful commitment to a hybrid belief system.